Hello, my name is Lauren Sarand, and my favorite thing is making jewelry and finding new ways to bring something beautiful to life.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is your Ooh, it is barely still Sunday edition. Who has busy weekends anymore? I watched a lot of TV. I watched a whole season of Are You the One from MTV, and then I watched most of season 4 of Big Mouth, the cartoon. I spent a day in meetings at my synagogue, and all of a sudden, it's 11 p.m. on Sunday night, and I haven't released my Sunday episode yet. So it'll be Monday on the East Coast, but Sunday in the Midwest and further west. This week, I talked to Lauren Sarand. As you'll hear, Lauren was a book publicist who I met many years ago through the Pilcrow Lit Fest, and we've kept up over the years. Last year, I was amazed to see that she was giving up her apartment in New York and selling a lot of her stuff and moving to Italy. And then she moved to Italy, and I didn't hear much until she was back in New York. Lauren and I catch up about her year in Italy, much of which was during COVID, but she moved to Italy to study the art of jewelry making. So it's fascinating to hear how one artist's date at a jewelry making class turned into a year in Italy. I hope you enjoy this episode. You can find Lauren on Instagram, and there's lots of great links in the show notes. If you're enjoying the shows, please rate and review on iTunes or wherever else you can rate and review. Send an episode to your friend based on whatever their favorite thing is. And as we head into the winter towards this vaccine, we still got to stay home, stay safe, wear your mask, and wash your hands. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we find out about people's favorite things and we get recommendations without using an algorithm. It's also my trick to find people that I love and adore and have long conversations with them. So today I am so pleased to be joined by Lauren Sarand. Lauren is based in New York today. Today you're based in New York.
Exactly.
We know each other from the world of book publicity. When I interviewed Jill Alexander Esbaum, we talked about Pilcrow Lit Fest. And so Lauren and I met for the first time at Pilcrow, a literary festival in Chicago, and we've stayed in touch and try to have a drink when we land in the same city. And so how are you doing today, Lauren?
I'm doing really well. And it reminds me that Chicago connection through Amy was through a connection. I met her in Omaha. So I feel like you are kind of connected to all the chapters of my Midwestern sort of life too.
Yeah, it was such a great, there's so many people on Facebook when I go and I look and I'm like, wait, how do I know them? And I'm like, Pilcrow. There's this like all of my Facebook friends who are authors, yeah. 95% of them are people I met at that event.
It was amazing. I will always, always, always remember it. Today I'm doing pretty well. I'm in New York, and I'm just kind of thinking about the world and the sort of season that we're in. It's kind of fall slipping into winter, and I try to be really sacred about my weekends right now, because otherwise it's a little bit like Downton Abbey, like what's a weekend if all the days are the same? So I try to have a different structure and a different approach. So I'm feeling really good because I decided that I would just devote today to creative projects.
That's wonderful. Well, I'm glad that you were able to make some time for this creative conversation.
Absolutely.
So when we get into like the favorite thing, we're going to start talking about jewelry making, yeah. But how has this COVID pause been for you? Because you were in Italy when COVID started, right? Yeah. Or were you like just coming back?
No, I was fully in Italy when it happened. I just came back to America on August 31st, the day my visa expired.
Okay.
So I was in Italy. I was in jewelry school. And basically, I was not permitted to have my own business and have a student visa. And I found that out very late before I left for Italy. So I went there knowing I probably wouldn't be able to stay forever and probably not even like the whole 2 years to get the degree. But I wanted to stay as long as I could. So I knew, you know, around New Year's that, barring a kind of miracle, I would be coming back to the States. But yeah, I was there through the lockdown. You know, I quarantined when I got back to America. But the difference between life here and life in Italy, and obviously, you know, COVID-19 is raging everywhere at the moment. But, you know, there, like the lockdown was complete. Like you couldn't go out and walk around. Like that wasn't allowed. And so, when it lifted, it really lifted. And so we lived with the kind of rules that people here describe as a lockdown, but it was post-lockdown there. So I've kind of, I think, had a few extra months of like really strict protocols. That feels really good because I feel like I'm pretty sure about my habits and kind of the decisions that I want to make and how I want to approach things. And I don't think I would have felt that way, you know, had I been in New York and had I been working at that time. Obviously my business would have imploded because I primarily, you know, in the previous iteration of my job as a publicist, did black tie events and really high profile kind of literary and cultural publicity primarily. And like that is 100% like literally high touch drinks, meetings, face-to-face conversations. And I think it would have been a lot harder for me had I not already been broke student. And like had no idea what my future was going to be like. I didn't plan to come back to New York, but financially I had to do it. I think like not really having a vision for the future, I wouldn't say anyone is prepared for this moment in time, but I've just been really open to things being different than the way that I hoped or dreamed that they would be. And that there's real kind of magic and possibility, even in a future that you didn't imagine for yourself. I feel that grounds me because I didn't have a vision of what my life would be like or expectations, because when I was living in Italy, I only wanted to live in Italy. And it wasn't until the very last month that I was there, when I was in Puglia in the very south part of the country, that I started to realize that I hadn't failed, but rather that I'd opened a door.
Yeah.
And that if I really, you know, worked it and I could have a life here in New York where I can work and support myself, which is meaningful. And a life there where I can kind of pursue the passions and the art and the creativity and where frankly I feel more like myself. I would like to have both. And it turns out my cat is very good at international travel.
Really?
So, yeah, he's totally silent on the plane. So, and the train. He does not like Roman cabs, but I understand.
I mean, who does like a Roman cab?
It was funny because he was really good, like on an 8-hour train trip, but the train doesn't really move that much. And when we were in this very short cab ride, it was just like, you know, all over the place. And I was like, okay, I'll minimize that for you because you're so great in other ways.
Yeah.
But I hope to go back. I mean, I don't know what it'll be like this summer, but my current plan, I only signed a lease here through the end of May. I would like for us to go back for the summer, but we'll see.
That'd be wonderful. So your cat got to travel in the cabin with you? I guess cats do.
Yeah, he just sits by your feet in a bag.
That's great.
Yeah, well, I found him on the street and he was actually 8 weeks old when I found him, which is the borderline of a cat staying feral.
Yeah.
So he's more wild than most cats. And wild cats don't cry when they're afraid because they don't want to be seen by you because they're wild. So he doesn't meow or anything. He goes into like panther mode and he's like silent and totally invisible. But for the most part, he just sleeps. Like he's actually, I don't know why, I feel really lucky. I didn't know what it would be like when I brought him over there. And I actually left him here for 6 months because I wasn't really sure and I didn't know what was going to happen. And when I came back last year at Christmas, I thought, well, we'll just go and just see how things go. And I'm so glad because I don't know how I would have made it through a lockdown like that without, you know, another soul in the house.
Yeah, I was the interview that I'm editing to release tomorrow is a friend and I, we both live alone. We both have two cats. And I think everybody looks at, can look to their left or look to their right and say like, well, lockdown would be easier with more people in the house because you'd have people to talk to and people to hug and more interaction. And I live alone with cats. So I look to my other side and I'm like, oh, living alone without animals must be like so hard. But I know people look at me and say, you live alone with animals. That must be so hard. I can't imagine going through COVID without an animal in the house, at least.
No, totally. I would love to get another cat for Toscano, but I think it's too much of a gamble because I would never put a cat in a bad situation. And if the cat didn't like to fly, I mean, it really matters to me. And so what I'm hoping is, I mean, I would love to have a man in the house who likes to take care of things. And if he had a cat,
right?
Ideal. But we're also quite content the way we are.
Yeah. I've also said that to a friend, that how nice it would be to have a man with a dog. Like, I love dogs, but I don't want the full responsibility of a dog, which is why I have cat.
Yeah. So I was thinking about getting, actually for Toscano's birthday, we ended up sending some money to this feral cat colony in Lecce in Italy for food. But I thought about getting a foster cat for a month so he could have a friend because he does seem lonely. But then I thought that would be, then when I stopped doing that, I would be kind of, I think, exposing him to a new sort of heartbreak.
Yeah.
So now my new thing is like, no, like a man with a cat. We have a life together.
Yeah. Let's, because we've talked about Italy a little bit, and you were in Italy studying jewelry making.
Yes.
So what was the program you were in?
I was in a two-year program at a school called Alchemia. Basically, what happened is a couple of years ago, I started taking weekend courses in New York. Then I started going to night school for a certificate in jewelry design and marketing at Pratt. And then towards the end of the year in 2019, I had the opportunity to go and study at Alchemia. Just the stars aligned for me to go and do it. And so I signed up and I wanted to go for the two-year program, but it's a bachelor's degree. And like, I mean, I went to college 20 years ago, right. So it's not that big of a deal that I didn't finish it. Because I did the first year, which was really the basic metalworking experience that I needed, because it's not the style that people work in New York. It's a little bit different. So I was really, really happy out of that experience. So yeah, I was in a formal program. I did it full time. I didn't do anything else. I went there every day like it was my job.
Amazing. Yeah. So take me back to the first class you took in New York. Was it a gift? Like, was somebody like, Lauren loves an experience, she'll do this? Or did you seek it out? Like, how did you find that very first class?
Well, it's really funny because I was going through all my photos on my camera last night because, as I said, I live alone with a cat. And so I was just looking at the last couple of years of my life. So I had read The Artist's Way, and the deal is that you do these kind of dates every week where you just do something creative. And my thing in life is that, you know, I've traveled around the world for work. I was always in motion and I love paintings. I would always go and see art. I would always read. But it's a very like, you know, the experience is you looking at something. And I remember at some point in the process after, you know, going to the Met four or five times where I have all my favorite paintings memorized since I was 17 years old, I thought, I want to do something different. And I remember walking around that night and I was like, it'll come to me. And suddenly I was like, I want to go to a jewelry workshop. I wear tons of jewelry, but I had never thought that before. I found a place where you could just go and make a really simple bracelet. And last night I remembered that I stopped in the subway and I took a picture of this mosaic that said fate. And I was so struck by that. And I went to the class and it went really well. And it was fairly simple. Like, you were just making a bangle bracelet, which, even though you may not think about it, you have to measure really precisely, because if it's bigger than your fist, it comes off. If it's too small, it's very difficult to put on. So we learned a bit about that and working with different metals, because, you know, copper, brass, and sterling silver, which are your primary metals in school, and for most jewelry, really, they have really different properties. You know, they melt at different points and some are harder, some are softer. So it was just like understanding an introduction to that. And they gave you the wire and then you cut it and you soldered it yourself to melt it and join it into a bracelet. So it's pretty straightforward, but like, you know, you're using a torch and it was cool, yeah. Very structured. And the teacher gave me really positive feedback and I was hooked. I was totally hooked. And so after that, I mean, I work as a freelancer. So it's all day and then it's in the evening usually. So the weekends were the only time that I could do anything. And I just started signing up because jewelry is very skills based when you get into metalworking.
Sure.
And a lot of people get into it by doing, if you put things together that are already made, that's usually called assembly. So a lot of people get into assembly, you know, they go to a craft store, they think like, I really want a necklace, and they find the pieces on online and they put it together.
So people that are, so when people are doing, going to like bead shops, that's for assembly.
Yeah. Like you're putting things together.
Okay.
And like you're using your eye and you're using some like, you know, there's some sophisticated skills involving. I learned how to string pearls and like, that's not easy. So that's like the kind of entry point, I think, for a lot of people. And then you can spend your whole life perfecting that.
Right.
And lots of different things, or you can end up kind of moving into these different areas of jewelry that typically are organized by material and focus. So I very quickly realized that I was super interested in working with the metal itself. And so I started going, so then you need like different skills, because like setting stone into a ring is a skill. Making a ring is its own skill. You have to learn how to do that. I used to wing it in the beginning because I'm a guy and I just like work really, really fast. And I have a super creative job where you're just like riffing all the time and improvising, and you cannot improvise with metal. Like I made these rings that would like fall off my fingers. I lost the first four rings that I made.
You lost the first four?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I know, like stupid. One, getting out of a cab after a really good dinner party, no regrets. It was a sacrifice that clearly had to be made. That much pleasure. But another one, doing like laundry. I would like to have that one back. Yeah, I really had to learn the hard way to size the rings exactly. And then also like in the beginning, you're really making stuff for yourself. So the temptation is like to make a ring the size of your finger. But if you have an idea to make jewelry to support yourself and to work and make money, which you really, most people end up doing because materials and studio time cost money as well, then the sizing has to be exact. You can't give someone a ring that is supposed to be a 7.5 and be like, it's kind of a 7.
Right.
Like, no one is taking that. So I had to learn precision. And then when you work in Italy, you do everything in the metric system, which I actually like better. But I was working on a piece today in my kitchen. I'm like using both. I keep being like, it's 5 millimeters. No, it's a 1/4 inch. And so I started doing the metalworking stuff, and I started doing rings, and I love rings. And I started learning that kind of stuff. And after I had done like probably 5 or 6 weekend workshops where you would go like the 92nd Street Y, where you work when I was 23, is a really, really, really great place for jewelry. It's super famous for having like the most affordable classes with fantastic teachers. So I did a 2-weekend like ring and stone setting intensive where like I got there, I think it was like Friday night. No, it was not Friday night, but it was Saturday. There was some time, and then it was Sunday, and then you picked up the next weekend. And so you ended up with something like, you know, 30 hours of instruction, because it was, I think, a day and a half each weekend. And so as a result, I learned how to set stones there. And after that, I was like, okay, that took a couple of weekends, and I can see how I want to do this like more in a linear way.
Because
I was like, not learning random skills, but you know,
but you were like patchworking it together with teachers who weren't seeing your progression.
Totally. And it was just too a la carte. So that's when I signed up for this jewelry design. And I took another entry level class at Brooklyn Metalworks, which was really good and really strong. And then after that, I decided I would go to this jewelry design and marketing night school program at Pratt Institute.
Okay.
And that was like more, that was like a semester schedule where you went to the studio every Saturday morning and you worked in the metal shop. And it was good because there's a lot of safety stuff that you need to learn, because it's really, really hot. There's many toxic chemicals. There's like melted liquid metal. There's pressurized gas. It really changed the way that I experience and see the world and interact with people, because now, I mean, I used to go to like Zen Buddhist retreats and I'm like, no, now I understand total attention. Now I get it.
Right. Because now your attention is the difference between like a 3rd-degree burn on your hand, getting a whiff of an, it's not just an odor, like it's a dangerous chemical. So are you doing in those classes? So my undergrad was in chemistry. So I spent a lot of time in the lab where you're working, your counter has a giant vent over it and it's got, right, your hands can go through, but your face can't. Are you like, what is a jewelry. I don't know. It's easy to think of it. It's like it's a cabin and it's a lot of like exposed beams and stuff. But what does a real metalworking jewelry lab look like?
Well, usually the gas lines are all clustered together. So you have benches, like little workshop benches, like you're in Pinocchio or something. And they all face each other like school desks in elementary school, because the most of the stuff that you're working with is quite concentrated. So it's very communal, which is why I'm not in a studio right now. And yeah, you have a workshop and your workbench has your tools, because there's a lot of precision work that happens and you have to vise things when you're working on them so that they don't slip away. Because every single day in Italy, I was like sawing my finger. I mean, people get the most of, like, you just see people do these things to their hands where you're like, it's amazing how the body heals. And so, and that just happens. It is just a consequence of learning. So you have just a lot of things at your bench. You have drawers, you have a tray that catches the metal filings, because you save them, because gold is very expensive. And so you can either melt the dust again and make it solid, or you can sell it.
Wow. How long did you study at Pratt before you decided to go head to Italy?
I think I studied Pratt. I began in September of 2018. And by September of 2019, I was like sitting at my desk in Florence. So it happened pretty fast.
Wow. Yeah.
The Pratt program, I was originally going to go through it in two semesters of night school. So my intention was to finish it before I left for Italy. And I mean, I was going to school for 3 or 4 hours a night, like 4 or 5 hours a week on top of working. But the last class that I needed wasn't offered, which is okay, because it was a branding course and I could easily teach that.
I feel like you know a thing or two about branding.
I thought it would be fun to go through like from the perspective of a jeweler, because being an artisan taught me a different way that people feel about what they make and putting that in the world. No, but when I got back this year, I asked to take color theory and practice instead, which is in the interior design program. And I've been having an amazing time in that. It's so fun. And so I'll finish that up in December. So I had about a year at Pratt, and then I went to Italy, and now I'm finishing that up. So my life is, I've just been on this really incredible journey after saying I couldn't change anything until it got so rigid it had to break when I was 40. And then, you know, everything's happening for me.
I find The Artist's Way and The Right to Write are Julia Cameron's two books, and they are so powerful. I was doing morning pages in 2003, and I got up one morning and I was just like, you know, dear God or whatever, because I hadn't converted yet. So it wasn't, there wasn't a God yet for me. Okay. And I was like, work has to change. I'm miserable. Like, help me find a way out of this. And that day I was offered the chance to go to London. They were like, we need you in London for 2 or 3 months. And also you have to leave in like 3 days. Are you cool with that? So I got to pick up and move to London. And I find that there's just so much magic available in that book, in The Artist's Way. And And you don't have to finish the book in order for it to have an impact on your life.
No, I never finished it.
Yeah.
I think it was that it taught me how to ask myself honest questions and then to listen for the answer. I think I had been so used to, as a publicist, you have to get very, very, very good at summarizing the plot of other people's lives and then selling it.
Right.
And so I kind of, there was a bit of confusion in my life about when I was working and when I was not, let's just say that. And so I had to really kind of get to know myself for the first time. I was so comfortable behind the scenes. I was so comfortable backstage. But the truth is, I mean, I was 38 and I didn't even have the faintest idea about who I was.
I think that intensity of work in your 30s can really mask a lot of things.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, like, I lived in New York since my whole adult life. And so when I moved to Italy, like, I sincerely felt that I was like quite a neutral person. And it was only in Florence that people were like, you were the most New York person we have ever met, like in the post office. And I was like, everything about my life, I realized I had been totally shaped by a place and totally shaped by a particular worldview that was very specific.
Yeah.
And I just had to let that shit go. Yeah. It was the best thing that ever happened to me.
I love it. September 2019, you're sitting in Florence.
Yes.
Did you was it a bilingual program? Did you study Italian before you went there? Like do you speak Italian? Did you speak Italian before you went?
I had this experience. So the moving to Italy was like two paths in my life merging.
Okay.
So I had this thing where I never, ever, ever went on a vacation, because when you freelance, you bill people in the eternal present. So it's like you take a vacation, it means you're like not making money and you're spending money. Like I've never really been successful enough and I've always been supporting myself. So like I never had that kind of cash. And you can't be like, oh, we're on the clock and I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks and out of range of you getting in touch with me. And even when I would do that, like I lost jobs over it and people were upset and it was impossible to kind of communicate those boundaries in a way that felt fair to everyone. So I just never really did it. And so when I was in my early, late 30s, I was paid partially by this publisher, Tyrant Books, in time at the publisher's family villa called Villa di Trapano in Italy. Uh-huh. And I took it as a way to negotiate the contract that would work for him and would work for me. Because he didn't have, you know, an unlimited budget and I needed to be reasonable about my fee. But it was great that we worked together. It was a really important book. I don't think I really intended to go in my mind. And then after a couple of years, he was like, you have to go. Like, I can't save this time for you forever. So I ended up going and my life changed like instantly. It was in this little tiny village that his grandfather had been born in. And the family had gone back eventually and like bought the castle at the top of the hill and they lived up there. I mean, it was just so romantic and incredible. And the walls were so thick that I didn't really have any reception.
Yeah.
And I instantly, you know, I would kind of get up, go swimming, like take a nap, like stare at the olive grove for 4 hours. People would be like, I've been trying to get in touch with you for 3 days. And I was like, I could not care less.
Yeah.
And that was like a kind of eye-opening thing for me in terms of just like the absolute sensuality of life, like just the astonishing, overwhelming experience of being in the present moment. So after that, and there was no way to speak English in the village. Like you couldn't buy groceries, you couldn't talk to anyone, you couldn't do anything. I came back to New York and immediately enrolled in Italian classes because I thought I'm going to want to go there every summer for the rest of my life.
Right.
So I was taking Italian for about 2 years, but I don't have any Italians in my life. You really need a lover for this to work well.
Right. Yeah.
And I have had lovers during this Italian learning process, but, and that's when you get like a year and 6 months, but you know, I just go to class. I don't really speak it outside of class.
Right.
People are like, I can't believe you're still an advanced beginner. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't do it that much. But when I was in Italy, I was the only person in my class that was taking Italian or who could communicate in Italian. Everyone else just spoke English and the class was in English. And I was actually really, I was very critical about that because yeah. I was like, well, you're a guest in another culture, in another country, A. B, you know, like don't represent that thing that everyone says about Americans, like they're not even curious.
Right.
And two, it's a beautiful language, it's a beautiful culture. And to be able to connect with people and to understand the way that they see the world, so much of which is expressed in how we talk and how we communicate and how we sum things up, like I can't imagine, you know, not having that kind of window onto things. So I studied Italian while I was there. And then I started again since I'd been back. So my goal is to, but you know, you think you know like the vocabulary and then you have to move on to different tenses.
Right. Yeah.
And like the other night in Italian class, it was like, you should have told me. And I was like, oh my God. It's like three different ideas of time collapsing.
Yeah. We had our sixth grade teacher, like rogue taught us Italian. She was Italian. And so like the sixth graders at Meadows Elementary in Terre Haute, Indiana, studied Italian for a year.
I love that.
I thought really helped set me up for, because I had then studied Spanish, was my minor in college. And I studied in Argentina, which is a very Italian country.
Yeah, for sure.
And then when I went, I've only been to Italy once. I spent a long weekend in Assisi and then like 12 hours in Rome.
Yeah.
And then I heard that because so many Italians immigrated to Argentina and Argentine Spanish is very Italian.
I was in a conversation about this the other night, actually, with a guy who's Argentine but grew up in Italy. And he was telling me about his accent. And I was like, oh, okay. And yeah, there's a whole take on that.
Yeah. So when I got to Italy and I spoke, I was like, well,
I don't have any Italian left, but I have Spanish, and I have Spanish with an Argentine accent, and we'll try. And I was trying, which is what's most important.
Yeah. So. And understanding a little goes a long way.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like there are people in Florence that don't speak Italian who have lived there for 30 years, and they live in a bubble. And it was hard because, you know, people who are native speakers of Italian didn't really want to listen to me talk to them like a child.
Right.
So I was lonely a lot of the time, but I would still try, you know, really kind of try and study it. And me, it was like, I spent so much time looking at art and in churches and kind of reading signs. And so it was this kind of total immersion. And there's something very kind of poetic about catching every fifth word.
Yeah. So when you got there, first of all, I agree. I can't imagine going to Italy for 2 years and not having an hour a day required grammar lessons. It just seems like, I assume you probably studied your Italian like outside of the school.
Yeah, because to be fair, like you go to school like 8 hours a day and you're hearing things the whole day that are like really difficult technical work. And like most of the time I would go home, make a cup of tea and pass out.
Okay.
That was kind of it. I did study Italian kind of, especially during the lockdown. I took an online course again. It was like, I don't know. I don't judge people's personal choices, but I remember I would always really encourage people because I just was like, you're missing a lot and it takes a long time. And, you know, I think that coming to this whole experience in my late 30s, you know, there were points when I was really sad because I felt that if I'd gone to Italy when I was in my 20s, like I would have had a lot more support, a lot. Like, you know, the school didn't help me with anything in terms of finding anything. Like I found apartment by putting a classified ad in the Florentine. You know, I had to go to the immigration police station by myself. And when I had a problem with my visa, I had to get a lawyer by myself. So it was just like, you know, there was just absolutely no infrastructure there in terms of like you being a person in a foreign country. I was just so alone. And I remember when I was leaving Italy, I was talking to someone and I was just saying that like, I would love to go back there and live there, but like not alone and not as a student and not without being able to, you know, speak a more advanced version of Italian than I do so that I could actually work. And so that's why I do it for 4 hours a week right now.
Yeah. So what were the types of jewelry that you were learning? So this was a metalwork school?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically every school has their attitude. And I think I only realized that sort of after going to all the, like every time you go to a school for a workshop, you learn their attitude right away. So
okay.
There's a school that I quite like that if I go back to studio in New York, I'll go there. It's not an official degree granting school, but they're really into using pure gold and they work in this Etruscan lost style of granulated gold that is so complicated that there was no way of telling how it was actually produced before ancient Romans until like X-ray technology in the 1930s.
Wow.
They do that there. It's called Jewelry Arts. It's amazing. And I'm like, I'll go back there. That's like a really serious place. And then like in New York, the style is really about like setting stones. You get everything sort of pre-made. But in Italy, if you want to make something out of silver, you go down to the Ponte Vecchio where the goldsmiths have been for 500 years. Mm-hmm. You buy raw silver. Then you do the math calculation. 925 is 92.5% pure, which means you have to make the rest of it out of other metals, copper usually. And then you go back to school and you melt it, you forge it, you mill it, you file it down, and then you start your project. So it just gave me a really different understanding of like where the process begins.
Wow.
Yeah. I know.
That is blowing my mind.
It's really interesting because the pieces that I did before here, the technical standard in New York is much lower because it's just not about being perfect, really. It's about being kind of eye-catching. And so in Italy, the standards were higher. Like all of your file marks have to be invisible. Like you just, it's unbelievable how rigorous it is. You know, when you make metal, it has natural imperfection.
Right.
In the machine made metal that you get in New York. So I began to find it like quite beautiful. And that became a sort of inspiration in and of itself, because like, you don't really know which way it'll pour. Like I was making a Japanese alloy called Shibuichi before I left, and a teacher was helping me, and we were melting a huge quantity of it because I was melting down all my metal before I was leaving. And so the teacher used this kind of oxygen torch, which is like so incredibly hot. You have to protect your eyes with this like fire. And, but it was so incredibly hot that it turned it a completely different color than it normally turns. So it's like super bright purple. And I remember just thinking like, oh, that's like the fun of the experimentation.
Yeah.
Like you constantly are in the elemental level of things.
Did it stay that purple when it cooled to a solid?
Yeah. I mean, that metal is really interesting because it's 60% silver and 40% copper. And so it's very, very hard. So you can't really set stones in it, but it has a gorgeous patina and it's kind of more lavender. It's got a pinkish lavender hue to it. And that just deepens over time. So in this instance, because it was so hot so fast, it's kind of intensely violet. But I imagine over time that kind of gray, you know, like the tarnish you see on a silver necklace you haven't worn in a couple of years,
yeah,
like come up and kind of enrich it and give it that sort of forest floor depth, but not yet.
So did you, when you were melting it down to be able to come back, were you like just melting it into something that now that you're in New York, you can melt it and reuse it? Or were you putting it into molds to later do more design on? Like what is the, what are you melting it to?
Yeah, I melted it down because I had my luggage shipped and I shipped my tools, but they couldn't be insured. And you can't lock the bags because of customs. And so I decided to carry all the metal with me. And like, you just can't have like 30 pieces of razor sharp silver in your handbag. So I melted them all down and they look like,
but I would watch that movie.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so much dust. I really can't, because you have these little canisters that you save the dust in and you're like, oh, wait, you know, you're very careful with the materials because they're expensive, but you just have all of these kind of odds and ends and you weigh them out when you need new silver or something like that. So I had like quite a lot and it was, yeah, I have a very pretty 18 karat gold ring that I made that's just a leftover gold wire.
Wow. Because my dad, now that I'm thinking about it, so he, my dad's undergrad was in sculpture, but he also did jewelry making because it was smaller in part, I think. And so for my parents, maybe their 20th anniversary, when my mom would be gone, my dad would be sitting at the kitchen stove. We had a gas stove and he was carving, he was carving wax rings to later like melt them and replace it with silver.
Yes.
And he was doing two interlocking rings that were, I think, and they were like the inspired by a photograph of the Challenger debris.
Okay.
So they were these very abstract rings, but you could lock them together into one massive ring.
Oh yeah. I can visualize that.
Yeah. And then they could each wear one, and he would, at night, he would be heating up like a metal poker, carving the wax and then hiding it all away from my mom when she would come home. And then he spun it out and did the replaced
silver. It's a lost wax casting.
Yes. Thank you.
I've done that a little bit. I was supposed to take a course in New York that got canceled. We didn't really spend any time in it in Florence. So that's definitely something I want to do like a dedicated class on.
Yeah.
It's amazing because basically you can do that at home and then you send the rings out to be cast. So if this kind of pandemic living, it becomes, you know, a multi-year sequence, or just if I want to have a studio in my house, it's a skill that I've, you know, recommended to a friend that has a small child, because not everybody, you know, even like working now in New York, the most I could go to a studio would be a day or two a week, and that's, you know, planning 6 months from now.
Yeah. And lost wax casting, the carving of the wax can be done incrementally. You know, you can do a few minutes here or there and a couple hours here and there and set it aside and come back to it.
Yeah, and you're also carving it and you have the tools, and it does not require any special skill other than carving the shape that you want in the lab. You have to have some kind of vision, and I guess some experience carving would really help, and being a natural sculptor would definitely help. But it's one of the oldest techniques that you see when you go to like a really old museum. Like, that was the original way that people did sand casting, which I did do in Florence, where you would make a mold and then pour that in. And so, yeah, we've had that with us as long as we've had fire.
Yeah. It's remarkable. Mm-hmm. So what were the, in your classes, were you, because you're learning the technical skills, you're learning the practical skills, would every class result in one finished object of jewelry, or would you work on, were you developing your aesthetic while you learn the, like, it's hard for me to imagine how you learn the practical, and at the same time, you're probably, are you also learning design, or was personal design in year two, or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in New York, like it's much more expensive to do this. And so you really bang things out. Like, I would make 4 or 5 rings in an hour. Like, those 4 rings that I lost, I made in one day. And they were really, really nice, and they were stone set, and they were great, but they were not the way that you would do it in Italy, where the expectations and the standards were completely different. So we did learn skills, and there was a lab in the morning that you went to from about 9 to 1, and that you just made something they told you how to make, and then you had to constantly show it to the teachers to meet the minimum standard to move on. So you would make these kind of replicas of the basic projects. So it would be like a hollow ring, or, you know, a ring with a stone in it, or the first thing is like a very basic brass ring, or you would learn how to combine metals, you would learn how to make rivets. Like, there were always kind of skills that you were learning. And then you would spend another part of the day in these kind of creative labs, because, you know, in New York, the attitude is really like, I would like to buy that. That looks great. I would love to pay for that.
Yeah.
In Italy, there's, for one thing, a really different conversation about the environment and kind of making things in your relationship to the material culture of the world personally. But also, I mean, people there, you have to explain why something should exist. Really the standard. Why should this exist? And so, yeah, I was learning just a different way to articulate my work and a different way to inform it. And like, it's just not interesting to them if it's already been seen in the world. So there's an experimentation with materials that's really interesting, and a kind of sense of, you know, it's a very contemporary jewelry school in a very old world city. And so you're learning like very traditional skills while like constantly pushing a kind of avant-garde edge in terms of what you're making.
Wow. And then in your free time, when you have energy, then you were also trying to go in, like you said, you were going to churches and you were trying to get out in Florence and see what it had.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would spend hours walking around. I got there a month earlier before school started, and I would walk around for 6 hours a day. It was the best time of my life in terms of just the, it was not, I mean, in Italy, it is true, every church that you go in will have some extraordinary art in it, because much of the art was created for churches and has largely stayed there. So you see everything in context, but also like the level of craftsmanship. I mean, in Florence, like, I never bought new clothes. I just wore vintage clothes from the market because I didn't have much money and they're nicer anyway. You know, if I bought shoes, I would buy like handmade shoes, and they didn't cost more than you would pay for like not very nice shoes in America.
Yeah.
But, like, the person in my neighborhood would make them, or you needed a belt, you would just like go to the guy who makes belts. And so it just had this like very different attitude towards life. And so like every single thing that was made by someone, like there was a real pride and a kind of sense of craft there. And on my street, you know, you could walk by these workshops where people like just make things out of bronze. You know, I lived in the Altrarno, which is the kind of historical kind of artist district of the city. And it's mind blowing. And it's all like little tiny shops with one person in them. And so just to look in the windows and the kind of antique dealers and to see the way that people put things together, you know, every single walk in that city was an education. And yeah, whenever I could, I would go to Venice or Palermo, or even just cities in Tuscany all the time, because the trains are really cheap. And they're all distinct, you know, Arezzo, Pistoia, Pietrasanta is where all the marble comes from. It comes down from Carrara in the mountains. And so Pietrasanta is full of marble sculpting studios, and they have a giant like outdoor sculpture court of just marble statues everywhere in the town because they're being produced there. So it's just like that constant immersion, you know, like the entire time I've lived in New York as an adult has been an incredibly vibrant time for the city in a capitalistic sense. But a lot of the sort of artistic energy of New York, you know, has been displaced, and everyone knows that. But in Italy, it didn't feel that way. It felt like people, you know, had a craft and they believed in it. And that was, you know, part of a larger ecosystem. And so Florence especially, like, was just such, and I knew the first day that I ever went there years before, a couple of years ago, I knew like the first minute that I walked over the bridge that I would live there. I just didn't know that it would happen so fast.
Yeah. What's your relationship to New York now, do you think?
Well, the biggest difference for me was that before I would have like really talked to you about my personal brand, which like doesn't even sound like words to me anymore. Like now I'm like, I have a job. I'm a consultant. I do it part-time. Like if I'm, you know, doing something else, I do not answer the phone. And so I think it really gave me a sense of like actual work-life balance. I don't know that it's sustainable in New York, because like my, you know, carefree attitude is not covering the bills at the moment, but it is really interesting to me because, you know, I came of age with the internet. So the internet was not a feature of life in my childhood or in college. But when I had my first job, it was. And because I was so into it, that was how I developed a competitive advantage that served me well throughout my entire career. But the thing is that, like, I still remembered when I was a young publicist, if you didn't have a story in the newspaper on television, you knew by 1 p.m. because the paper went to print. And so, you know, I had this really robust life. Like I fell in love, like after 5 o'clock, there was like a whole other day almost. And yeah. So you had friends and you did things. And that was so missing from my life in my 30s. It was the always on, always email me, you know, call me at midnight if you want to talk about your career thing. And in Italy, like, there's not even a word for publicist in Italian. Like I couldn't even explain to people what I did or that it was like, you know, a job that is prestigious in America. Like, ew. You
do that. Right.
I was like, it's like marketing. And they were like, how could you talk about that all the time? And I was like, I don't know. So it just kind of really brought me back to the part of my job that motivated me to get into it, which was the sense of like, I am a naturally skilled communicator. I am really, really good at connecting people with resources and community and opportunities. And I love working with artists and creative people and just people who are trying to tell a different story in the world that means something to them and to the people who need to hear it. And back to my roots in a way. But yeah, no, I like taking a whole day just to do creative things today and, you know, finishing up my night school thing and going to Italian. I mean, that definitely, and like just signing a lease through the end of May. Cause I'm like, well, I just don't see myself, you know, just working 70 hours a week, trying to kind of hold on to something here. I'm like, the thing about Italy was that life there was very hard for me. Like I cried a lot. It was difficult. I'm not writing a romantic memoir here in Tuscany by any stretch of the imagination. I think when we get stuck, it's because those are the places in our life where we need to learn how to be more flexible. And I needed to learn how to live without being, you know, without having social validation of being financially successful, without, you know, getting a lot of feedback from my job constantly. And like, my whole life was on social media before I left. So when I was in Italy and like, nobody really goes on Twitter, it was like, I had to find something else to talk about. So I think it just really, it challenged me to see things differently. And by the time I got to Southern Italy for a month before I left in Puglia, in Lecce, the stores close at 1 and they reopen at 5:30, 4:30. And you can't go out during that time. Wow. So yeah, it's too hot for one thing and everything's closed. So there I was just like, I learned how to ride a bike again. My cat started sleeping outside in this garden. Like I really started to kind of understand like the true possibilities of a day. And I started to just think like, how did you ever just spend 8 hours sending email? You know, like, you know, how is that kind of serving you? Like, that's a day that slipped away from the kind of record of your existence forever. Like, make them matter.
Yeah. I hear you on that. 'Cause I was in at PR and marketing agencies for 12 or 15 years. And in January, February, 2018, I was laid off. Mm-hmm. And only a month ago did I go back to a full-time job. Yeah. And that, like, 2.5 years of freelancing, it's, you know, my second attempt at freelancing. I did better this time financially, because I know my worth, or I know what people will pay for my time. And I was, I would say, like, I'm telling you that I'm here to facilitate retreats, but if you need a Leah Jones on a project, let's talk.
Right.
So I did a lot of really interesting work with people I never would have like pitched myself to. And now I'm doing marketing operations at a financial services firm.
Right.
Which is a really nice, well-balanced life to be out of the, right? That I don't have to think about how to make you care about a hotel brand during a pandemic.
Yes, exactly.
Or how to do a Super Bowl stunt during COVID, or how to do a, your Friendsgiving campaign when nobody can go home, that I'm not thinking about Zoom activations with celebrities, or how do you put Cameo and TikTok into your brand launch. And it is thrilling not to have to care about those things.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, in the spring, I was like, it's a lot to deal with, you know, but at least I don't have to talk about reporters, talk about it to reporters. I can just process it as a human being and a civilian and a citizen. It is really challenging. I mean, since I've been back, my work has been very different. I've been doing a lot more strategic consulting, and people seem to be much more interested in long range planning. And I am doing some publicity, but it's a very, very different mix. I spend a lot more of my time kind of helping people figure out challenges that they've identified in the last 6 months that need some change in the way they think about it, or the way they're organizing the resources to break through. I've even had like publicists as my clients since I've been back, who just want to kind of remake their business. So it's been really, really interesting. I mean, I do think the one thing about changing your life is that you realize you can change it, and like there's value in kind of learning that. So I've brought that energy to my projects. But yeah, no, in my long range life, like, I will always be connected to the world and the creative community, but I will not always be a publicist.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I just don't, I don't miss it. It was, for me, it was a time to find out also what my real interests were, right? Which, for example, it turned out wasn't Super Bowl commercials. That when left to my own devices, that wasn't.
This is what I was alluding to earlier. Like, I didn't even, I had no opinions when I was in my 30s. Like, I mean, I have a very specific idea about style and taste, 'cause like, that's my dominion, but like, I had no opinions about anything. Like, honestly, like, shared in public, I would promote my clients and that was it. And so, I had to really get in touch with that. And like, even lately, since I've been back, like, I did genuinely miss, like, going to Italy for a year and being legally prevented from working. I did sincerely miss being connected. You know, when I got back, I called Film Forum right away. I wanted to join their advisory committee again. Like, there was just a lot of stuff that I thought, well, like, I'm good at this and I'm doing it for the right reasons. And like, I do want to be of service. Like, I like helping people. Because in Italy, when I would try and help people with marketing, they were just like, what is this? It did not translate. And so, you know, they got it, but it just is not, it's not meaningful in the same way. And that's when you realize the American cult of celebrity is just like so overwhelming, and there are other ways of organizing the world. But when I got back, you know, I was like, okay, I'm totally happy that I can come back and be like fully booked right away and like have opportunity, but like in a different way, because I used to be booked like years in advance, and now I have like so much more flexibility and I can take on projects in the short term, but I'm super busy. But I just thought, like, I still, because I see how I made a path to Italy and I made a path to jewelry, I want to make a path to what's coming next in my life. And that is going to be like a deeply creative pursuit that's different than this. You know, there was a point when I was like, oh, I remember when I gave away literally everything I owned to get out of here.
Yeah.
I remember when I gave away my forks and why I was just like quit every single job that I had, even though I had a very good situation and I was at the height of my career. It just was not, you know, doing what I needed it to do for me, which was kind of like truly nourished me on every level. I was never making enough money to really save money. I was never able to buy anything. Like I was just treading water every month. And I just thought, I can't spend my 40s like this. I don't want to be here that much longer.
Yeah.
I would like to have a life here and a life in Italy, but like my future is for sure. The outlook is European. I love being in New York for some part of the year. And I would like to continue having clients and I would like to really do some like interesting collaborative cross-cultural stuff. I see like major potential for, but you know, living there made me realize I need a kind of richer and more varied life for myself that has more things in it that are not just, you know, working in pursuit of fame. So yeah. I'm going to have a little vintage boutique in December on Instagram. And then I think some point early next year, I'll probably put some jewelry up for sale. So I think every other month I'm going to have like some, maybe like once a season, I'm going to have like a month where I just pursue a creative thing.
Yeah.
On the weekends that, you know, is kind of purely my vision. I mean, the interesting thing that you learn in metalworking, and I think this is probably the same for all kind of passions, is that a lot of things kind of become what they want to become.
Yeah.
And you do not have kind of ultimate control over them. So in jewelry, like you're responsible for the technical kind of results, but everybody knows that when you start out, the fire could be different that day. If there's a draft in the studio, like you're 1 inch closer, further away. I mean, that will really fuck you up.
Right.
Because if you have so many times, so basically when you solder a joint, you're not actually melting it, but the solder is flowing and that's creating a link between the two pieces that are separate. But if you leave it 5 seconds too long because your piece is dirty and the solder won't flow, you could collapse something that you've been working on day and night for 2 weeks and then it's busted. So there's always that moment where you're like, I'm so close to perfection, but you're also a bit like Icarus, very close to one.
So that sounds exciting and terrifying.
It is. I mean, and there's a lot of failure in it. Like, I feel like being a career freelance publicist, like, it has taught me that, like, some days you succeed and some days you fail. And it, like, has kind of nothing to do with you. You only work in your time. You only work in your world. Like, I used to collect a lot of quotes by artists about working in their time because I always felt like the news cycle is... People in the cultural world just want you to talk about a project right now, but the news cycle is like actually going to tell you what people are going to talk about. And so I always used to think about working in my time, and Chris Marker, this great filmmaker, said, you know, in another time, he made these like very avant-garde politically charged works. He said, in another time, I would have been content filming girls and cats, but you don't choose your time. And so I thought about a lot, like, you know, we only have our commitment.
Right.
So many factors outside of our control in anything that we undertake. And like, I feel much more confident about speaking Italian than I did 3 years ago, but there's no comparison to living there in terms of getting better.
Yeah. You
know? So I just have to bide my time.
Yeah. Wonderful. Is there anything about jewelry making that I didn't ask you that you wanted to make sure that to share, or about Italy, or...
If I could have given myself any gift earlier in my life, it would have been the confidence to experiment in a small way. I think that I always saw change as kind of really this like major thing. And I had gotten really rigid and really kind of, I guess, binary in my thinking before I left. And that's why it was like, I'm leaving forever and I'm never coming back.
Right.
And it didn't work out. It was so heartbreaking to me. So I think for anybody who's thinking about even the mildest curiosity about jewelry, like start where you are. Like there's so many amazing resources online. You can watch an incredible tutorial about waxworking without ever having done it, or maybe even not even having the intention to do it, but just to kind of learn about how something happens. is so, so, so fun. And I think there's this one episode that I just watched for school. I think it's a PBS show. It's called Civilizations.
Okay.
Episode on color and how like color has had this role throughout time that's so transformative. And so I think, yeah, just for me, jewelry began because I was curious and I didn't stop myself from pursuing it. And I learned like there's so much power in that. And when I came back to New York, I thought New York will be different because you're different. And everything in my life is so completely like my life now, my life 2 years ago wouldn't even look the same in a movie.
Yeah.
I think jewelry making, if it calls to you, like follow it. And anybody can write me anytime if they have questions. Like, I'm more than happy to answer them. I think you should always have a jewelry friend in your life, and you should always have someone who tells you the truth.
Two good friends to have. Even better if they're the same person. Is there anything that you would like to promote or have people follow you online or?
No, I feel like I just came here in the spirit of conversation and I've been given a gift. So thank you.
Great. Well, I'm so happy to get to catch up with you. This has been wonderful.
Nice to hear your voice.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.